brew, cooking in the hopper. The first time Rory met Willa Sachs, who was crazy, beautiful, beyond real life beautiful, was over cups of green tea in her offices in the Capitol Records building on Vine Street in Hollywood. The home she shared with her venture capitalist husband was somewhere in the hills nearby. She could not have been a nicer person, chatting with Rory about art and raising horses. Rory knew very little about either. Willa changed the subject to Fiji. She had been to the islands to do research for the movie. She told Rory about the beauty of the night sky and the clarity of the water and the happy faces of the locals, especially during the traditional kava ceremonies that were held to welcome visitors. She had learned to surf there. The movie would shoot in Fiji for at least 2 weeks. The meeting lasted a little over an hour. But before Rory was in his car and at a standstill in the afternoon traffic of the Hollywood freeway, his phone exploded with texts. W. Sachs loved you! $! Two weeks later, he was officially cast as Caleb, with a crazy payday of nearly $500,000 to be spread over 3 films, which could or could not be part of the Cassandra Rampart universe. The next time he saw Willa was at the studio for camera tests. A production assistant took Rory to her trailer. When he climbed up the steps, wearing his torso-clinging Caleb Jackson surfing outfit, she sized up her no-name yet gorgeous co-star and said, "Well, ain't you hot shit?" The start date of the movie was delayed for a few months as the script was rewritten, then pushed to after the new year so Willa could enjoy the holidays with her husband. They spent Christmas in a castle in Scotland. Rory's first day playing Caleb Jackson was in late March on a soundstage in Budapest. Willa had been shooting for 3 weeks and had her own makeup trailer, so the two did not see each other until they were on the set. The scene called for them to make out in a shower, but the water was not hot enough to hiss out any real steam, so the Hungarian SPFX crew rigged the stall with a smoke machine. When Willa came to the stage in her bathrobe, her 3 security guards circled her chair. She asked Rory if the hotel was working out for him, then told him that now that she was married, she never kissed on screen with an open mouth. Over 7 months, Rory shot only a few days a week, in Budapest, Mallorca, back in Budapest, in a stretch of desert in Morocco, then in Rio de Janeiro for a scene that called for Willa and Rory to run through the crowded streets of Carnival, a scene that took 4 days to prep and 16 minutes to shoot. Rory himself shot a week in Shreveport, Louisiana, while Willa took time off with her husband in the Seychelles. They met up again for a day of additional running through carnival scenes, but this time in New Orleans. Because some of the film financing came out of Germany, tax laws forced them to shoot one scene in Dusseldorf. They ran out of a building and jumped into a taxi, the extent of the Dusseldorf filming. After 10 days of reshoots in Budapest, they had only the surfing scenes yet to do. They never did go to Fiji. Instead, Rory and Willa grabbed shots against a green screen at the exterior water tank in Malta, pretending to surf on SPFX gimbals as stagehands doused them with very cold water from dump tanks. Day 3. 7:30, grooming in room. 8 to 9, hotel restaurant. Breakfast with contest winners. Note, Eleanor Flintstone will join for coffee at 8:50. 9:05 to 12:55, principal TV interviews, 12 minutes each. 1300 to 1320, luncheon room. Room service menu to be provided. 1320, touch-ups. 1325 to 1625. Principal TV interviews continue. Break. 1630 to 1655. TV interview, Le Showcase, hosted by René Ladoux, a French icon of film criticism. 1700 to 1730. TV interview with Petite Choupie. Petite Choupie is a puppet who will ask you to sing along with her, song TBD. 1735 to 1825. Join Eleanor Flintstone in Ballroom for TV Interview with Claire Brühl for FTV1. This is France's most widely watched women's show. 1830 to 1900. Photo shoot with Eleanor Flintstone for Le Figaro. 1905 to 1955. Photo shoot for Orphaned Pets Organization. Note, there will be dogs, cats, birds, and reptiles. 2000. Transfer to motorcade. 2030. Arrival at Jardin des Tuileries. 2030 to 2100. Work red carpet press line. Interviews. Photo call. 2105 to 2200. Concert by popular French singer. TBD. 2205 to 2230. Live remarks to crowd. Note, you will introduce Eleanor Flintstone. See Irene for suggested remarks. 2235 to 2245. Fireworks. 2250 to 2300. French paratroopers recreate Cassandra Caleb drop into volcano caldera. 2305. French Air Force flyby. 2310 to 2330. Unveiling of CR3 DAH holographic billboard. Note, crowd will be provided with holographic glasses upon arrival. 2335 to 2415. Performance by popular French pop star, TBD. Eleanor Flintstone to proceed to airport. Stage is cleared. 2420 approximate. Screening begins. You are free to stay for screening or return to hotel. Note, tomorrow will be travel day to Singapore. French telephones do not ring. They go bleep, 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 bleep. At 6:22 a.m., the sound is like having a barn animal in your hotel room. Rory had to stop that sound. Yeah. The receiver felt like a toy up to his ear. Change of plans, Pumpkin. Irene was on the phone. You get to stay in bed.
Say what?
Rory was still a bit woozy, having taken advantage of the Hotel Maurice's bar until just 4 hours ago. The schedule for today is in flux, Irene said. Go back to sleep.
Watch this.
Rory put the phone back in its cradle, rolled over, and was out like a glass-jawed boxer. He woke up 3 hours later and stumbled into the sitting area of his hotel suite. Good enough for Nazi officers in the day, and just fine and dandy for Mrs. Thorpe's only boy. The schedule for his day 3 in Paris was on the desk beside the room service menu, and a media packet on Cassandra Rampart 3, Destiny at Hand. At 9:46, Rory was supposed to be giving TV interviews of 12 minutes each, but neither Irene nor anyone else had come to fetch him. Tomorrow he'd be flying business class on Indo Airways to Singapore, so he ordered up a few cafe au lais and a bakery basket from room service. He had spent very little time in any of the hotel rooms, save for exhausted sleep and grooming, always by two women, one for makeup and one for hair, both ushered into the suite by Irene while Rory showered. Alone, in his underwear and sipping coffee and hot milk, Rory checked out the place. The hotel had been recently renovated in hipster millennial, which would have been a blow to those Nazi occupiers of long ago. A black screen was the TV. The remote for it was long, thin, heavy, and incomprehensible to any American. The lamps were all touch-controlled, but only if you knew where to touch them. Four bottles of Orangina drink were arranged neatly on the square coffee table, ironically next to four porcelain replicas of oranges. The sound system was a retro turntable with a collection of LPs by the Elvis of France, Johnny Hallyday, one record going all the way back to the 1950s. There were no books on the shelves, but there were three old typewriters. One keyboard was Russian, one French, and one English.
Bleep, 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 I'm awake.
You sitting down, Pumpkin?
Give me a second.
Rory poured himself the last of the hot milk and a final cup of coffee, balancing his cup and saucer as he rolled back on a leather recliner.
I'm actually reclining now.
The press tour is canceled. Irene was old school. Press junkets were what corporations organized to sell product. Press tours were what movie stars did to promote their films. Rory spit cafe au lait all over his bare legs in the leather recliner. What? Go online and you'll see why.
I never got the Wi-Fi password.
Willa is divorcing that venture capital vulture of hers.
Why?
Well, he's going to jail.
He do something crooked to piss off the feds?
Not the feds. Hookers. In his car on Santa Monica Boulevard. Seems he was in possession of something other than his medical marijuana, too.
Wow.
Poor Willa. Willa will be fine. Weep for the studio. Cassandra Rampart 3, Destiny at Handjob, will take a hit at the box office.
Well, should I call Willa and tell her how sorry I am?
You can try, but she and her team are on a plane somewhere over Greenland. She'll hide out at her horse ranch in Kansas for a few weeks.
She has a ranch in Kansas?
And she grew up in Salina.
Well, what about the big events on the docket for today? Fireworks and the French Air Force and all those orphan pets.
Canceled.
When do we go on to Singapore and Seoul and Tokyo and Beijing?
We don't, Irene said without an ounce of regret in her voice. The outlets want only one thing, Willa Sachs. No offense, but you're just a guy in her movie. Rory, no one. Remember that poster I had in my office that said, what if they gave a press conference and nobody came? Oh, wait, you've never been to my office.
Well, what happens now?
I leave on the studio plane in an hour, not looking forward to that 12-hour bitch-a-thon. The movie opens domestically in 4 days, and the first paragraph of every review will be about hookers, OxyContin, and the man who paid for sex while wed to Willa Sachs. Sounds like the plot of Cassandra Rampart 4, the parole hearing.
How do I get home?
That'll be handled by Annette in the local office.
Who is Annette?
Rory had met so many people throughout the junket, the names and faces might as well have been of Martians. Irene called him Punkin a few more times, told him he was just aces all around, real mensch, and that she thought he was going to have a fantastic career should CR3DAH make its money back. And she liked the movie, actually. Thought it was cute.
I don't speak Russian. The French language has too many letters and punctuation marks to make sense to me. Good thing this other typewriter is in English. I think Willa Sachs, a.k.a. Eleanor Flintstone, is a great gal who doesn't deserve this. She deserves a better guy than one who likes streetwalkers and hillbilly heroin. A guy like me. Not once in 1,000 interviews did I ever confess my deep and constant crush on that lady. Irene told me not to be that honest with the press. Tell just enough of the truth, but never lie. I have a pocket full of money, per diem. In every city, Irene handed me an envelope of cash. Not that I had the chance to spend any of it. Not in Rome, nor Berlin. In London, I had no free time. Maybe I should see what pleasures a few euros will buy me here in Paris. Later! I went outside of a hotel on my own for the first time since Berlin. Hey, Paris ain't bad. I was expecting the usual hordes outside the hotel. The fans hoping for a glimpse of Willa. Hundreds of them, mostly men, duh, have been waiting outside. Photographers, autograph hounds, etc. Willa called them the paper boys. They're gone now. The word probably having gone out that Willa Sachs has left the City of Light. Annette Le Boogie Doogie says, just because the junket is canceled, I don't have to fly home immediately. I am free to linger in Paris and all of Europe if I want, but on my own money. I just did some wandering around, in fact. I crossed the river via a famous bridge, then walked right by Notre Dame. I dodged the scooters and the bikes and the tourists. I saw the glass pyramid of the Louvre Museum, but did not go in. No one recognized me. Not that they should. Not that they would. Rory, no one. That's me. I walked into the gardens, the place where we were going to have a huge event with rock bands and jets flying by and fireworks and
thousands of people wearing free 3D glasses. Instead, crews were breaking down the stage and the screen. The barricades were still up, but were made moot. There was no one to keep back. Beyond the gardens was a big traffic circle called Place de la Concorde. Millions of cars and Vespa scooters, lanes and lanes of them going both ways, and around a monument needle in the center. The huge Ferris wheel has been there since 1999. Bigger than the one in Budapest. When was that? When did I make the movie there? What, in junior high? The one in Paris is not nearly the size of that one in London. The one that goes around only once, very slowly. When did we have that huge press conference in front of that thing? The event that had the children's choir and the Scottish Mounted Light Cavalry and one of the lesser members of the royal family. When was that? Oh, right, last Tuesday. I bought a ticket, but did not have to wait long for the Ferris wheel to let me on. Hardly anyone was in line, so I had the car all to myself. I went around a bunch of times. Up high, I saw the city stretch to the horizon. The river wind its way to the south and to the north, with many fancy long boats sliding beneath all the famous bridges. I saw what is called the Left Bank, and the Eiffel Tower, and the churches up on the hills, and all the museums along the broad avenues, and all the rest of Paris. Before me was the whole of the City of Light, and I saw it for free. Our Town Today with Hank Fassay, an elephant in the press room. So many rumors here at Da Paper. The bull elephant in the room says the Tri-Cities Daily News Herald is giving up the economic ghost of a printed version of our great triple metropolitan newspaper. If, when such a business move is made, the only way you'll be reading my column and everything else you now hold in your hands is on one of your many digital devices, your phone maybe, or a watch that needs recharging every night. Such is progress, but it makes me think of Al Simmons, a rewrite man at the old Associated Press. My career at the AP lasted close to 4 years, but I would have been quickly pink-slipped were it not for Al Simmons, who took the choppy prose and school kid syntax from my reporter's notebook and turned those scribbles into bona fide news copy. Al is long gone, bless his heart, so he never saw the advent of reading a newspaper on a laptop or pad. He passed away before the idea was any more real than the Starship Enterprise. Not sure the man even had a TV, as he complained that nothing good was on the radio since Fred Allen went off the air. This story is now carbon dating me. Al's typewriter was a Continental, a beast nearly the size of an easy chair, bolted to his desk. Not because anyone would try to steal the thing, you'd have been foolish to have tried to lift it. Al's desk was a small, narrow altar of editing. He would bang out his version of my copy, leaner, crisper, better, dang it, then flip up the typewriter on hinges, and on the cleared space go at his own stuff with a blue pencil. The man made quite a racket doing his job a few hundred times a shift. The chunka-chunka of his typing, and then the ba-ding of the bell and the crank of the carriage return, the shrip of the copy from the machine, and the kabunk of his tossing back of the massive tool of his trade to scribble away with an even more primitive mode of writing. Al was at one with that typing machine and was never more than a yard away from it and his desk. He sent me out for coffee and food on many occasions, but when I came back with the delivery, he'd be hacking away at some copy and I'd have to set the food on a nearby stool until he flipped up the Continental and made room for his lunch. If Al Simmons sounds like a stereotype, a cartoon version of a newsroom denizen, he was, in every way but one. He didn't smoke, and hated all the dopes at the AP who did. Quiet! Reporters working would be a superfluous sign here at the Daily News Herald these days. We've been on computers since the 80s, though the first generations of them were called word processors. That was what we called ourselves. The point being, Al Simmons would not be able to fathom how we have been reading our newspapers in ever greater numbers over the past 5 years, bent over our handheld miracle machines. Two, he'd not recognize how we put out the newspaper for the last 3 decades. "Where's the roar and fury of a newspaper going to press?" he'd holler at me. In Al's honor, here's an experiment. If you are reading this on your phone, I'll write some of it on mine, my edited, proofread stream of consciousness. I'm going to miss reading a physical copy of the paper, on newsprint, delivered to my front lawn 7 days a week by a fellow named Brad, who scoots by in a car, chucking my copy out the window with but the smallest of deceleration. Or from the copy I read at the Pearl Avenue Cafe on Pearl Avenue a few days a week, I'll miss the sensation of a story placed above the fold on page one and the shame of a story being relegated to page B6. I admit, I get a kick out of seeing my face and my byline, my column, on the back page, so easy to find. And did you know a reading of the column and the timing of a soft-boiled egg are a perfect match? If, when, the Tri-Cities Daily News Herald goes all digital, no print, this reporter will be sad, resigned, at the advent of this thing we call reality. And Al Simmons, in Rewrite Heaven, will scratch his head in confusion, his typewriter flipped up forever. Now, an autocorrected version, pinched out on my phone. I'm going to miss reading a physical copy of the paper on newsprint, delivered to my front lawn 7 days a week, be a fellow named Bark who scores B-U-V a cat, chai hubs my cope in the window, Eugene the Shanked, the Doctor Fijishigrist, or FYI. The color I eat at the Peak Avibura Cadge on Zoe Scratfanud a few days a week. I'll miss the sensation of a dying place, Abu D to gold page one, and the shame oif of duties relegate to OFSSSH6. I admit I gat a kick out of this C in my FXE and my Belai, my Viking on gauge back page. So easy to find. And did you know a reading of the volume and the timing of a foot hulked egg is a perfect match? If when the Tri-City Savaki need heard highs all digital, thus router will be sad resigned at the advent of hugs, gajing called result, and Al Simmons in re-ra-ra-ra-heaven will scratch his head in confusion, hos toyila totorier flipped up forever. Gotta run now and get my copy down to the press room. Welcome to Mars. Kirk Allen was still asleep, in bed, under a quilt and an old army blanket, as it had been since 2003 when he was 5 years old. His bedroom was also the back room of the family home, one he shared with a Maytag washer and dryer, an old, chipped, out-of-tune spinet piano, the idle sewing machine his mother had not used since the second Bush administration, and an Olivetti Underwood electric typewriter that had been rendered inoperable when Kirk spilled a root beer float into his innards. The room had no heat and was always chilly, even on this early morning in late June. His eyes were rolled up into the back of his head as he dreamed he was still in high school, unable to dial the correct combination for his gym locker. He was on his seventh attempt, turning right, then twice around to the left, then once back to the right, when a flash of lightning made the locker room blindingly white. Then, equally suddenly, came a darkness that encompassed his whole world. There were more flashes, like sheet lightning, then blackness again. Everything white again, then an impenetrable black, over and over. But there was no rumbling thunder, no claps of Thor echoing off the distant canyons. "Kirk! Kirkwood!" It was his father. Frank Ullen had been snapping the overhead light on and off, his idea of an amusing wake-up signal. "Were you serious last night, kid?" Frank began singing. "Kirkwood, Kirkwood, give me your answer, do."
"What?"
Kirk croaked. "About going to Mars. Say no and I'm gone. Say yes and we start your birthday like true Ullen men, brave and free."
Mars?
Kirk's brain flickered into consciousness, and he remembered now. Today was his 19th birthday. Last night after dinner, he had asked his father if they could surf in the morning like they had the day he turned 10, and again the morning he turned 13. "You bet," his father said. "Conditions at Mars Beach would be good. There was a swell coming from the southwest." Frank Ullen had been surprised at the request. His son had not joined him in the water for some time. Mr. College Kirk was not as willing to brave the elements as he'd been in high school. Frank tried to remember the last time he and his son had surfed together. 2 years? Three? Kirk had to ponder his schedule for the upcoming day, which was hard to do right out of his dreamland fog. Birthday or not, he had to be at his regular summer job, manager of the Magic Putt Pee Wee Golf Course at 10 a.m. What time was it now? 6:15? Okay, this could work. His dad, he knew, had only one job site going, the new mini-mall on Bluff Boulevard. Yeah, this was doable. The two of them could pound the waves for a good 2 hours, or until their shoulders dislocated. It would be good for the two of them to be back in the water. Once again, the submersible Ullen boys, princes de la mer. Kirk's dad was a carefree man in the water, on his paddleboard in the morning. The hassles of the job and those flare-ups at home were left on shore. All those complicated family moments that came and went, as unpredictable as brush fires. Kirk loved his mom and his sisters as dearly as life itself, but the fact that they were such squeaky wheels on such bumpy roads was something he had accepted long, long ago. His dad, the father of the pride, had to work two full-time jobs, provider and peacemaker, with never a day off. It was no wonder the man took to surfing as both his physical tonic and his mental astral plane therapy. For Kirk to head out with his dad would be a bracing vote of confidence, a manly huddle, a backslapping, "We are in this together, you and I," birthday embrace. Name a father and son who didn't need that.
"Okay," Kirk said, stretching with a yawn, "I'm coming."
"No law against staying under the covers."
"No, let's do it."
"You sure?
You trying to avoid getting wet yourself?"
"No way, knothead."
"Then I'll be your huckleberry."
"Excellent. Breakfast fit for a long-haul trucker 12 minutes. Frank disappeared, leaving the light on, making his son squint protectively. Breakfast was savory perfection, as always. Frank was a master in the morning kitchen. His forte was timing. The kielbasa got to the table hot off the stovetop. Skillet biscuits were soft and butterable. The coffee pot was 8 cups deep, an old Mr. Coffee. And the eggs were never dry, so the yolks were fluid gold. Cooking a dinner was beyond his capability, something about having to wait around for a shank to roast or potatoes to boil. No way. Frank Ullen preferred the bang-bang immediacy of a breakfast. Cook, serve, eat. And he made the morning meals fun when the kids were young and the family lived on a schedule. The breakfast conversations as heated, sometimes too heated, and thick as the coffee-laced hot cocoa Frank gave them starting in third grade. But these days, Mom slept so late, she was never seen at breakfast. Chris had escaped to San Diego, where she lived with her boyfriend. And Dora had declared long ago that she would come and go as she pleased, on her own clock. So it was just the men at breakfast, dressed in baggy surf sweats, unshowered, since what was the point if they'd be in the water? "I'm going to have to make some calls about 8:30, business shit," Frank said, flipping some biscuits onto a plate. "Won't take too long. I'll leave the water to you for an hour or so." "You got to do it, you got to do it," Kirk said. As always, he'd brought a book to the table and was already absorbed in it. His father reached over and slid it away from him. "Architecture in the 1920s?" Frank asked. "Why are you reading this?" "For the racy parts," Kirk said, soaking up Polish sausage grease and egg yolk with a biscuit. "The Jazz Age was a building boom until the Depression. Post-war engineering and materials changed every skyline in the world. I find it fascinating." "Those exterior supporting structures made for wedding cake buildings. Everything got smaller the higher you went. You ever been to the upper floors of the Chrysler Building?"
"In New York City?"
"No, Dime Box, Texas.
Dad, you raised me, remember? When did you ever take me to New York City to see the upper floors of the Chrysler Building?"
Frank took two travel mugs down from the shelf. "The top of the Chrysler Building is a feckin' rabbit warren." The last of the coffee went into the mugs, which Frank placed on the dash of the truck while Kirk pulled his board, all 6 feet 6 of it, out of the storage shed. He tossed it into the camper, where Frank's 11-and-a-half-foot paddleboard, the Buick, took up most of the room. 6 summers before, the camper was brand new, purchased for a momentous vacation, a 2,000-mile loop up the coast of Canada, across the two lanes of British Columbia, Alberta, and Saskatchewan, all the way to Regina. The trek was a long-planned Ullin family retreat and came off as promised for the first few 100 miles, anyway. Then Mom started sharing her opinions and insisting on behaviors. She wanted to establish her rules of the road and began giving orders. Thus rang the opening bell, beginning the first of what became many punishing rounds. The verbal joust became serious disagreements, escalating into full-throated, mean-spirited arguments that had to be won by the mother of the family. Chris, as was her wont, turned her rebelliousness up a few notches. Dora's righteousness devolved into deep crevassed silence, punctuated with outbursts so fast, loud, and vitriolic as to be near Shakespearean. Frank, at the wheel, sipping on his cold coffee or warming Coca-Cola, acted as referee, therapist, fact-checker, and cop, depending on the point made or offense taken. Kirk, as his defensive stance, pulled out book after book, reading like he was a chain smoker with a carton of menthols. For him, the psychodrama faded into a background din not much different from the wheels of the camper humming across thousands of miles of asphalt. They argued their way across Canada, continued as they came south through the vast American prairie, the space so open, so endless, it was said to have driven some of the original settlers insane. The Ullin family went certifiably daffy in Nebraska when Chris bought pot from some guy living out of his car at a KOA campground. Mom wanted to call a cop and turn in both the dealer and her own daughter. She went DEFCON ballistic when Dad allowed no such thing by simply packing up the camper and driving away, fleeing the scene of the crime. The camper went frosty, like a bitter family Christmas in July. No one talking to anyone, while Kirk finished all of William Manchester's books on Winston Churchill. By the time they turned due west in Tucumcari, New Mexico, everyone wanted off the road, out of that truck, and away from each other. Chris threatened to hop a Greyhound bus the rest of the way home, but Dad insisted they do some camping in the desert, which they did under protest. Chris got high under the stars. Dora went on solo hikes until after dark, and Dad bedded down outside in the tent. Mom slept in the camper, guaranteeing
she'd be alone in peace at last by locking the door. That was a problem, as it cut off access to the bathroom. Thus ended the last family vacation for the Ullins. The last family anything for the Ullins. The camper stayed bolted onto the King Cab pickup, serving as Frank's mobile office surf buggy, one that had not been cleaned or vacuumed in 21,000 miles. In his youth, Frank Ullin had been a real shaggy-haired surf bum. Then he grew up, got married, had kids, and started an electrical wiring business that took off. It was only in the past year that he had once again begun to leave the house before anyone else was awake to make the point break at Mars Beach, a tight right-hander best in a rising 3 to 4 foot tide. When Kirk was a kid and a part-time beach rat, father and son would park on the highway shoulder and carry their boards down the well-beaten path to Mars. To young Kirk, hefting his original sponge board, the beach seemed as rocky and far away as the bottom of Valles Marineris on the Red Planet. The economic boom years had drastically altered the place. There were inland luxury apartment complexes built in what had been marshes, and 5 years ago the state had paved over a square of weeds and dirt, creating a real parking lot for $3 a car. Mars was no longer free, but it was conveniently accessible. Surfers headed left at the sand, regular beachgoers veered to the right, and county lifeguards kept the two apart. "You haven't seen this." Frank was exiting the highway at Duke Magian State Recreation Area. Kirk glanced up from his book. What had been a field was now flattened and surveyed. The little flag posts were already planted, with a sign advertising the site of a future big box mart. Remember when the nearest business was a taco stand at Canyon Avenue? It's now a Chisholm Steakhouse. "I remember taking a shit in the bushes," Kirk said. "Don't swear around your old man." Frank pulled into the lot, parking in an empty slot one row away from the path gate. "Well, what do you know?" he said, as always. "Welcome to Mars." A collection of shops had evolved on the other side of the highway, under low-slung roofs made to look like Mexican adobes. There was a surf gear shop, a recent and ubiquitous Starbucks, a Subway sandwich place, a Circle W convenience store, and the office of a loan insurance agent named Saltonstall, who had set out a shingle there so he could surf when the phone wasn't ringing. An auto shop fast lube and tire franchise was under construction at the south end of the shopping center. "A lube job while you surf," Kirk noted. "That's environmental consumer integration." "Here's your handbasket. Enjoy hell," Frank said. The parking lot showed a collection of aged and rugged vehicles, rancheros and station wagons loaded with tools, owned by construction workers who were grabbing waves before work. There were old vans and self-painted VW buses owned by surfers sleeping overnight, despite posted ordinances that exclaimed, "No camping." When the county sheriffs periodically rousted the surf bums, there were always lengthy legal discussions about the difference between camping overnight and waiting for daylight. Lawyers surfed Mars, too, as did orthodontists and airline pilots, their Audis and BMWs strapped with roof racks for the boards. Moms and wives would be in the water, good surfers and kind people. Fistfights had once been frequent, when the high surf attracted kooks from all over. But this was a weekday, and not all the schools were out yet, so Kirk knew the crowd would be easygoing and manageable. And the Martians, as they called themselves, had all gotten older, mellower, except for a couple of asshole lawyers. "Sweet break this morning, Kirky Bird," Frank said, eyeing the water from the parking lot. He counted over a dozen surfers already in the water, as large waves, the swell, were shaping in regular intervals outside the lineup. He unlocked the door to the camper. They pulled both boards out, and Frank's paddle, standing them up against the truck as they yanked on their summer wetsuits with the short legs and built-in rash guards. "Got any wax?" Kirk asked. "In the drawer there," Frank told him. His paddleboard had a mat, so he didn't need wax anymore, but he kept some for those who might need some stick for their sticks. Kirk found a cake in a drawer full of junk, including shortened rolls of duct tape, old mouse traps, a hot glue gun but no sticks of glue, boxes of staples, and a set of channel locks that was going to rust in the salt air. "Hey," his father said, "put my phone in the refrigerator, would you?" He handed over his mobile. "Why the refrigerator?" Kirk asked. The thing had not worked in many years. "If you broke into this camper and wanted to steal anything of value, would you look in the busted icebox?" "You got me there, Pop." When Kirk opened the door, not only was there the dank smell of years of non-use, but there was also the sight of a small gift-wrapped box. "Happy birthday, son," Frank said. "How old are you again?" 19, but you make me feel 30. The gift was a waterproof sports watch, a newer model than the watch Frank was wearing, all black and metal, a heavy-duty military chronometer already set to the correct time. Strapping it around his wrist made Kirk feel like he was about to board a military helicopter to go kill bin Laden. "Thanks, Dad. This makes me look cooler than I am. I didn't think that was possible." "Hoopy boofty, Junior." As they carried their boards down the path to the beach, Frank said again, "I told you I'm going to have to make a few calls around 8:30. I'll holler at you when I get out of the water. I will salute my recognition." Standing in the sands of Mars, they watched a set of waves play out as they attached their board leashes to their ankles with Velcro straps. About a dozen large, well-shaped curlers came along before the surf lessened, allowing Kirk to run into the tide and hop on his board and paddle out, duck-butting through the smaller waves as they broke over him. He'd be lining up just beyond the break with the younger surfers, those who shredded the faces of as many waves as Poseidon sent their way. As a paddleboarder, Frank sought the larger waves off of Mars, those well outside, beyond the lineup, where along with the other stand-up surfers, he'd wait for the larger sets of heavy water, the waves generated by storms in the South Pacific that grew muscular with mileage. Before too long, he easily caught the shoulder of a wave, rising up 6 feet or so above its floor, riding gracefully in wide turns. As he was the surfer closest to the curl, the wave was rightfully his own, the other Martians peeling off to leave him to it. When the wave closed out, he hopped off his board and held his position in the shallows until the set died. Then he hopped back up, his feet shoulder-width apart, dug his paddle into the ocean, and crested each ridge of incoming water until he was outside again. The air and water were cold, but Kirk was glad he had gotten out of bed. He recognized old Martians like Bert the Elder, Manny Peck, Schultze, and a lady he called Mrs. Potts, the veteran longboarders. And there were kids around his age, some of the pals he grew up alongside who are now like him, in college or the workforce. Hal Stein was in graduate school at Cal. Benjamin Wu worked as an aide to a city councilman. Stats McGee was studying for his CPA license, and Buckwheat Bob Robertson was, like Kirk, still an undergrad, still living at home. "Hey, Spock!" Hal Stein called out. "Thought you died!" The five of them waited in a circle between rides, comparing the notes they'd kept since adolescence. Kirk was reminded of just how good Mars had been to him. Living within driving distance of its waves had allowed Kirk access to a world all his own. At Mars, he grew comfortable in the powerful waves of the place. Mars was where, alone, Kirk tested himself and excelled. On shore, he was a statistic, a tick mark smack in the middle of a bell curve, neither a dropout nor a scholar, not an ace or a deuce. Other than a couple of English teachers, Mrs. Takemashi, the school librarian, and the crazy, gorgeous, honey-haired Aurora Burke, before her new stepfather whisked her off to a new family in Kansas City, no one had ever singled Kirk Ullen out as being special. But in the water of Mars, Kirk was master of all he surveyed. He was glad he'd been coming to the place for years and could be there this day as he turned 19 years old. After so many rides, he had lost count. Kirk was pooped. So he rested in the lineup. When the morning sun came out, he could see the tops of the vans and his dad's camper in the parking lot, the tile roofs of the shops across the highway, and the rocky scrub-brush hills beyond. With the blue water against the brightening sky, Mars took on the look of a sepia-toned photograph of some legendary surf locale in Hawaii or Fiji, a color image long since faded to an amber tint, turning green mountains into yellow and brown hills. If Kirk squinted, the Mexican-themed shops became bures on a slip of beach, native huts on an atoll in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Again, Mars became a different world, and Kirk was its king. Sometime later, he heard his father calling him from the beach. Frank had laid his board on the sand, planted his paddle like a flag, and was making the hand gesture universally translated as, "I am going to make a phone call." Kirk saluted his father just as Mrs. Potts screamed, "Outside!" Sure enough, a set was shaping up well offshore, the waves as visible as humps on a washboard, breaking at least 50 yards early, making for dozens of long, aggressive rides. Everyone paddled furiously. Kirk was tired, but he was not about to sit out a great set. He stroked hard and steadily until experience told him to wheel around and paddle toward the beach. He caught the third wave that came his way. As he was rising up on the apex of water, instinct timed his springing to his feet for the drop into the wave's trough. This wave was gorgeous, well-shaped and smooth-faced, and huge, a monster. Kirk kicked out of the trough and climbed up the face just in front of the curl of white water, a compressed whisper of wind at his back. He jerked left and shot down perpendicular to the arc, pulled right at the bottom, and again sluiced up the face. He topped the very crest, bounced along the rim, then dug once more into the slot, retarding his speed to allow the break to catch up with him. He knelt as low on his board as his physique allowed, until water was bending over his head and he occupied the little green room of the curl. Rushing water was on his left, the smooth glass of the surface on his right. He dragged his fingers of his free hand in the wall of green like the fin of a dolphin, a knife in the water. As ever, the curl closed on him. The water smacked him on the head, and he wiped out. No big deal. Churning in the white water, he relaxed, as he had learned long ago, letting the wave roll beyond him and allow him time to find the surface and fill his lungs. But the ocean is a fickle mistress, Mars indifferent to human effort. Kirk felt the leash go taut in the Velcro around his ankle. In the foam and chaos, his board snapped back, nailing him hard in the meat of his calf. The hit had the same blunt force as the blow from a croquet mallet Chris had once taken to him in the backyard, which sent him to the doctor and her to her bedroom. Kirk knew he was done for the day. He felt for the sandy bottom, knowing the next monster was about to crush him. He lunged up for a breath, sucking in air, seeing 7 feet of white water roaring down on him. He ducked under the wave, blindly felt for the Velcro of his leash, and ripped it off his foot so his board would get tossed toward the beach and away from him. He floated in, no panic despite the pain in his leg. When he made contact with the sand again, he was farther inland and could hop on 1 foot to get his head above water. The next incoming wave pushed him closer to shore. Another did the same, then a few more. He crawled out of the water and onto the beach. "Fucker," he said to himself. He sat on the sand, his legs so deeply gashed that white tissue showed, along with torn flesh and pulsing blood. He was going to need stitches, sure as shooting. Kirk remembered a day when he was 13, when a kid named Blake got hit by his own board and had been pulled unconscious from the water. Blake had been nailed in the jaw and needed months of dental work. This wound was not as serious as that, and Kirk had suffered a few lumps in his time. but this chunk taken out of his leg was worthy of a Purple Heart. You okay? Ben Wu had come out of the water after retrieving Kirk's loose board.
Oh, shit!
He yelled at the sight of the cut. You need a ride to the hospital? No, my dad is around. He'll take me.
You sure?
Kirk stood up.
Yeah.
There was pain, and blood was trailing down his lower leg, splattering drops of scarlet in the sand of Mars. But he waved Ben away and said, I got it. Thanks. He took his board and limped on up the path toward the parking lot.
You're gonna need like 40 sutures in that thing,
Ben called out before leaping back into the surf atop his board. Kirk's calf was throbbing in time to his heartbeat. He limped up the path, his leash trailing in the sand-covered walkway. More beachgoers had arrived, so the lot was two-thirds filled, but Frank had parked close. Kirk expected to find his dad inside the camper at the table, talking business on his phone with papers spread in front of him. But when he rounded the back of the truck, the camper door was locked, and his father was nowhere to be seen. Kirk stood his board against the door, then sat on the bumper to inspect his leg, which now looked like a kielbasa had exploded. Had the board hit him a bit higher, it might have shattered his kneecap. Kirk felt lucky, but the sooner he got to an emergency room, the better. His dad was probably across the highway, in a store grabbing a drink or a protein bar, the key to the camper in the zippered pocket of his wetsuit. Kirk didn't want to hobble across the highway carrying his surfboard, nor did he want to leave it for a thief in the parking lot. He looked around to make sure that no one was observing him. Then he stood on the bumper on his non-bleeding leg, shoving the board up onto the camper roof, where it would be out of sight from the ground. The leash hung down, so Kirk knotted it in a messy ball and tossed it up as well. So much for protective measures, he thought, then headed for the highway. An overgrown bush provided shade as Kirk waited for an opening in the morning traffic. When a gap showed, he made his move, skip-hopping across the four lanes. He checked the subway and the Circle W, looking through windows but not seeing his dad. The surf shop would make sense. Maybe he was picking up sunblock. Heavy metal music blared from inside, but no one was in the place. His last and best bet was the Starbucks at the north end of the shops. Coffee drinkers were reading papers and working on laptops at the outside tables and benches. Frank was not one of them, and if anyone bothered to look up at Kirk with his open wound, they didn't say anything. He entered, expecting to find his dad, roused him off the phone, and set off for the appropriate medical attention. But Starbucks held no Frank.
Holy shit!
The female barista saw Kirk standing there, bleeding.
Sir, are you okay?
It's not that bad, Kirk said. Some customers looked up from their cups and laptops without responding.
Should I call 911?
The barista asked. I got a ride to the clinic, my dad, Kirk said. Has Frank been in, ordering a venti drip with a shot of mocha?
Frank?
The woman thought for a second. A lady ordered a venti drip with a shot of mocha a while ago with a decaf soy latte, but not a Frank. Kirk turned to go back outside.
We have a first aid kit.
Kirk scanned the parking lot again and the walkway of the shops, but still did not see his father. On the off chance there were tables on the other side of Starbucks, he eased his way to the corner, but found no tables and no Frank, just parking spaces under eucalyptus trees. A single car, a Mercedes, was parked on the other side of a thick trunk of one of the trees. Kirk could see only the front end and a bit of windshield. Starbucks cups, two of them, were sitting on the dash. From the passenger seat, a man's hand reached out for what Kirk knew to be a venti drip with a shot of mocha, because he recognized the black band of his father's military-style chronometer. A watch just like the one Kirk now wore on his own wrist. The windows of the Mercedes were rolled down, allowing Kirk to hear the lilt of a woman's laughter along with his father's amused cackle. Kirk didn't feel his leg anymore. No pain at all, as he edged closer to the tree, able to see that much more of the car, as well as the face of a woman with long black hair, and a smile aimed at his father Frank was facing the woman, so Kirk saw only the back of his head. He heard his father say, "I better get back," but his father didn't move. Kirk knew from the relaxed, quiet tone that his dad wasn't going anywhere. Kirk slowly backed off around the tree to the corner, then around to the door of the Starbucks. He went back inside. On the wall opposite the entrance, windows spread over three small tables that looked out onto empty parking spaces in the shade of the eucalyptus trees. Kirk went to the windows and craned his neck. He saw the woman with long black hair, her arm resting across Frank's shoulder, her fingers playing in his sea-salted hair. His father was swirling his drip mocha in its cup. He was sitting on a beach towel that covered the passenger seat, as though his wetsuit had not already dried. The woman with the long black hair said something and laughed again. His father laughed too, in a way Kirk rarely saw him laugh, with his teeth showing, his head raised back, and his eyes squinting, a silent movie, the dialogue muted by the window of Starbucks. Kirk heard only the tapping of fingers on laptop keyboards and the commerce of premium coffee drinks. "Why don't you take a seat?" It was the barista again, named Celia, according to her tag. She had a metal first aid kit. "I can put on some kind of bandage, at least." Kirk did sit. Celia wrapped his leg in gauze, the white staining red immediately. A glance back out to the shade of the eucalyptus tree showed the woman with the long black hair leaning forward, her mouth open, her head tilted in the body language known universally as a prelude to a desired kiss. His father leaned in toward her. Recrossing the highway was a blur, but Kirk did think to retrieve his board from the roof of the camper. He walked back down the path to Mars. The surf line was still crowded with riders, the high tide about to turn in the hours-long recession to the low watermark. Besides his father's board and planted paddle, Kirk sat in the sand, his mouth dry, his eyes unfocused, his ears deaf to the roar and rush of the waves. He looked at the bloodied bandage on his calf, remembering that he had been cut deeply by his own surfboard. But it had happened when? Weeks ago. He slowly ripped the tape from around his leg, then unwrapped the scarlet-stained gauze, kneading the sticky heap into his fist. He dug a hole in the sand, a deep hole, then put the snarl of trash in the bottom and covered it up again. The wound immediately began to bleed, but Kirk ignored that, as well as the swelling and the pain. He sat, confused, suddenly ill, feeling like he was going to cry. But he didn't. Whenever his father returned, he would find his son, recovering from a surf accident, waiting for him to finish his business calls, so they could go get 40 stitches, at least. No one came by him, neither up out of the water nor down the path from the parking lot. Kirk sat, alone, dragging his fingers in the sand like a small rake, for who knows how long. He wished he had a book to read. "What the fuck?" Frank was striding across the sand, his eyes wide at the sight of his son with such a gash. "What happened to your leg?" "My own board," Kirk told him. "Jesus!" Frank knelt in the sand, inspecting the wound. "Must have made you say ouch." "I did say ouch," Kirk told him. "Wounded in the line of battle," Frank said. "Hell of a birthday present," Kirk told him. Frank laughed, like any father would when his only son takes a hit and shakes it off with stoic humor. "Let's get you to the clinic. Get that cleaned out. You sewn up." Frank gathered his board and paddle. "You're going to have one sexy scar." "Sexy as hell," Kirk told him. Kirk followed his father up the path, away from the surf line, leaving Mars for the last time and forever. A month on Green Street. The 1st of August is usually only so notable, the start of the 8th month, in the middle of summer on what might or might not be the hottest day ever. But this year, yowza, a lot was going on that day.